A short reading from a summary of the Fundamentalism Project, a 10-year effort centered at the University of Chicago by Martin Marty. Fundamentalist movements have emerged in seven major religions: Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hindu, Sikh, Buddhist, and Neo-Confucian. Despite different doctrines, organizational structures, and political settings, they share common traits. Fundamentalists are convinced of a conspiracy between secularists and liberal religion and adopt strategies to fight back. Male charismatic leaders emerged in each tradition. They ransacked the tradition's past and retrieved politically useful doctrines in order to construct a religio-political ideology, one that is capable of mobilizing disgruntled youth into militant cadres and grassroots political organizations. Ideologues established sharp boundaries between insiders and outsiders and imposed strict discipline on followers. They elevated their mission to a spiritual plane of apocalyptic urgency. Western myopia on this subject has been astounding. U.S. citizens, safe to practice their faith openly and nonviolently, have failed to recognize the religious nature of political violence elsewhere. Despite the high visibility of fundamentalist movements, there is a tendency to underplay religion as a force in politics and to minimize the complexity of church-state relations. The dominant explanatory view of religion is reductive, treating it as peripheral to the economic, political, and psychological realities that matter. Ever since the Enlightenment, the principle of separation of church and state has been an essential criterion of modernity and the measure of liberty. Unfortunately, this has misled us to assume that religion is and must remain strictly a private matter. Here ends the reading. During a final exam, a physics student read this question: "Describe how to determine the height of a skyscraper using a barometer." The student wrote, "Tie a long piece of string on the barometer and lower the barometer from the top of the building to the ground. The length of the string plus the length of the barometer is the height of the building." The instructor was incensed and failed the student. The student appealed. An independent arbiter came and said to the student, "You have 6 minutes to answer this question to show that you know some physics. Otherwise, you're out of here." For 5 minutes, the student sat in silence. Then he stood, gave his answer. "Well, you could take the barometer to the roof of the building, drop it over, and measure the time it takes to hit the ground. The height of the building is then equal to 1/2 g times t squared, but that's bad for the barometer. If the sun is shining, you could measure the length of the barometer, then set it on its end and measure the shadow, then measure the shadow of the building, and then its proportional arithmetic to work out the height of the building. You could also tie a piece of string to the barometer and swing it like a pendulum, first at ground level and then at the top of the building, and the building's height is calculated from the difference in the restoring forces, 2 pi square root of L over G. Now, if the skyscraper has an outside fire escape, you could climb the stairs and mark off the height of the skyscraper in barometer lengths and add up. Now, if you wanted to be boring, you could use the barometer to measure air pressure on the roof and then on the ground and convert the difference in millibars into meters and get the height. However, since we are encouraged to exercise independent thought, the best way would be to knock on the custodian's door and say, "Would you like a nice new barometer? I'll give you this if you will tell me the exact height of the building." The student was Niels Bohr, awarded the Nobel Prize, among many 20th century physicists who dwelled in ambiguity and possibility and uncertainty. Scene one, Pennsylvania. The Amish community named Bird in Hand. Saturday afternoon at the Yoder farm. Frank Yoder unhitches the horses. Anna and the kids carry shopping bags into the house. The Yoders have returned from the world to their Amish Gemeinde, their spiritual enclave. Mr. Yoder grudgingly obeys the law. He keeps a phosphorescent red triangle on the back of his buggy. The Amish disdain cars because their presence would enable kids to contact the world. Anne unpacks the groceries while the kids set up rows of benches. Tomorrow the Gemeinde will gather for worship. The Amish, who scorn church buildings, gather in homes. They follow teachings that have guided the Amish since 1697. They are ultra-traditional, but they are not fundamentalists. They don't call themselves that, nor do their friends or their detractors or the media. The Amish mind their own business and hope that others will just let them alone and respect them. They are not antagonistic, and they don't proselytize. Scene two. It's high noon on a Sunday in Carmel, Indiana, suburb of Indianapolis. Ray and Jenny Morris speed home from a large Southern Baptist church in their Lincoln Continental. They always park at the pole position in the church's six-acre parking lot to make a fast getaway so that Ray will get home for the kickoff of the Colts game. These very modern folk are fundamentalists. They're proud of that. They are proud that their pastor helped the fundamentalist faction take over the Southern Baptist Convention. The Morrises represent an embattled form of spirituality. They are engaged in conflict with those whose secular practices and beliefs seem hostile to religion itself. But they do not withdraw from the world, quite the opposite. They are very well connected. They understand basic human needs and are committed to serving these needs. They've established vast networks of hospitals, colleges, daycare centers, and schools, and they fund them generously. They are attempting to resacralize an increasingly secular and presumably hostile culture. Fundamentalists are line drawers, especially on the question, am I good enough? How do I measure up? But unlike traditional folks such as Amish, fundamentalists focus upon being good enough and judging others, which often can degenerate into violent certainties, both verbal and physical. Such violent certainties, of course, have been part of the human condition all along. But since around 1920, religious fundamentalism has reared its head with vitriolic intensity, spreading through now social media at the speed of light. Today, I want to do these things. First, to highlight some key traits of fundamentalism, then suggest why fundamentalism has emerged with such vitriolic intensity, and then ask how might we begin to engage or even break the cycle, the escalating antagonism of right-wing fundamentalism versus left-wing fundamentalism. How can we engage this dilemma a bit more imaginatively than responding to one fundamentalism with another fundamentalism? Okay, what's going on here? Remember, it was Mencken who wrote, "Fundamentalism is the terrible, pervasive fear that somebody somewhere is having fun." And there's something to this. How many fundamentalist comedians are there? I don't know. Yet there are more basic aspects that you and I need to be aware of. 5 ideological and 4 organizational characteristics of fundamentalism. Very quickly, what are they? First, reactivity. Fundamentalism is reactive. It's high voltage. It seeks to counteract any progressive force. Many major world religions are losing members to the secular world right now, or losing members to relativism, the belief that religion is culture-bound and therefore can change. Fundamentalism is reactive to this. Second, fundamentalism is selective. It carefully picks out parts of its heritage, especially texts that focus on purity and separating the in-group from the out-group. For example, Protestant fundamentalists cite apocalyptic prophecies in Daniel and Revelation. The Italian Catholic movement, Comunione e Liberazione, selects the theology of Karl Barth. Shiite movements select texts legitimizing the political role of learned jurists. So there is selective cherry-picking of something that will serve an agenda. Fundamentalism also may adopt some aspects of modernity if it serves their purpose. For example, it was the access to cheap audio cassette players in the 1970s which allowed the Ayatollah's sermons to be spread throughout even the smallest villages where they could be played on boomboxes. Fundamentalism does take advantage of modernity if it serves their purpose. Dualism. The fundamentalist world is sharply divided into light and dark. The world outside their enclave is doomed. It's only the world inside that can be redeemed. Inerrancy. Scriptural texts such as the Torah, the Talmud, the Halakha, the Quran, the Sharia, the Bible, and the Granth Sahib are considered of inspired origin, true and accurate in every particular. This is especially true of the Abrahamic religions. In Eastern religions, gurus and monks have a somewhat freer hand in working with selected texts, but even in these movements, fundamentalists affirm absolute validity and inerrancy of texts. Millennialism. Fundamentalists believe that history will have a miraculous culmination. Goodness will triumph over evil, immortality over mortality, and eternal justice will be restored to terminate history as we know it. Four organizational traits. An elect, chosen membership. Fundamentalist movements have an elect and divinely called membership, described variously as the faithful, the remnant, the last outpost, the covenant keepers, saints. There are various designations, but believing in one's chosen status is a powerfully manipulative technique to foster group solidarity. Sharp boundaries, a sharp separation between the saved and the sinful. That dividing wall may be physical. For example, Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem enforce physical separation with a distinct vocabulary and dress code and tightly controlled access to the media. Authoritarian organization. Typical fundamentalist organizations are charismatic and top down. Followers attribute extraordinary qualities to their rebbe, their imam, their virtuous jurist, or other charismatic person at the top. And finally, conformity. Oh my gosh. Fundamentalists enforce conformity within the ranks and often focus their most intense hostility, not outward, but to backsliders very close to home. And they will do whatever it takes to purify the ranks from freethinkers and potential backsliders. Such zeal is nothing new. But fundamentalism, at least in the U.S., became a specific term only around 1920 in a Baptist periodical. So what happened? Recall a bit of history. During the late 19th century, progress onward and upward was the norm, guided by industrial expansion. But in the aftermath of World War I, amidst the carnage of Flanders Field and elsewhere, optimism went down the tubes. Even the optimists were beginning to realize that something was terribly wrong with smiling, happy-faced theologies. What to do? Get back to the fundamentals. Reclaim scriptural absolutes. Draw sharp lines in the sand. And so fundamentalism, American style, emerged in the early 1920s, flattening the Bible's rich imagery and ambiguity into absolutes and using it as a weapon. During the first few decades, fundamentalism remained really on the fringes of public life. It was discredited for its anti-intellectual stances. It was not taken that seriously until around 1960. In fact, prior to 1960, prior to about 1960, there was hardly any publishing house in the U.S. that would even touch a fundamentalist manuscript submitted to it. But around 1960, three events launched fundamentalism onto center stage. The first was the power of television to reach into every economic and social niche. The second was a dramatic turn to the right in politics, where greed and profiteering and looting the common good for the private good became a favorite indoor sport. Became and has perhaps intensified, depending on who you look at. When right-wing religion gave sanction to right-wing politics, it was a marriage made in heaven, literally. The third event, which fueled fundamentalism onto center stage around 1960, this was a little later actually, was the collapse of communist regimes, leaving us no evil empire to demonize. So what to do? Well, find a new adversary. And thus arose the project for the new American century, whose founders included Wolfowitz, Pearl, Cheney, and Rumsfeld. And their proposal, written prior to 9/11, was to Americanize the world, beginning with the Middle East. And we are still reeling from the consequences of this little bit of national arrogance. Meanwhile, Islamic fundamentalism was bringing Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, and bin Laden onto their center stage. Amidst the secular stampede and the arbitrary carving up of the Middle East after World War I, Islamic fundamentalism took root in populist elements within the Sunni Arab world. Ordinary Muslims saw Western powers establishing a military and commercial stronghold throughout the Middle East. Muslims directed their harshest criticisms toward the corruption of their own leaders who had betrayed Islam by accepting bribes and by building economic alliances with the representatives of Western greed. And this left the field wide open to religiously unschooled but deeply disgruntled laypersons many of whom had solid backgrounds in engineering, applied science, or business. And it is from these disgruntled laymen in the Middle East that terrorists are recruited. And more are eagerly awaiting their call to martyrdom, even as we speak. Fundamentalism is not going to disappear anytime soon. Why not? I think fundamentalism is kind of like a default setting. It kicks in whenever chronic anxiety in any system exceeds some threshold. Whenever folks become chronically anxious in coming to terms with a changing world, fundamentalist voices will emerge. They react to landscapes of change by drawing sharp lines. Fundamentalism is a default response whenever modernity is feared. Recall the lessons of history. The ancient Near East for thousands of years has had one focus: purity, perfection. Root out the impure. Root out the impure. In the first century in Palestine, this fixation on purity took two forms: the Essenes and the Pharisees. The Essenes handled it one way. They retreated into the desert, to Qumran, to isolate themselves from the impure world in Jerusalem and elsewhere. The Pharisees went the other route. The Pharisees became the legalists and line drawers. They pursued perfection not by escaping, but by trying to root out the backsliders. They were the legalists of the time. And into this matrix of purity, there came a hillbilly rabbi who had another message that was very threatening, because this rabbi, Yeshua, spoke of wholeness from an entirely different perspective. He said that wholeness, that's a better word, that wholeness emerges not from shutting ourselves off from society and not from nitpicking out glitches within society and finding out what's not good enough. He says that wholeness in our communities emerges from table fellowship, from breaking bread together. Be compassionate even to the despised and rejected. So Yeshua threw the protocol out the window. He spoke of communities not of like-minded folks, but for the nobodies. He invited not a political revolution, but a social one at the most dangerous depths. He said that holiness does not mean separation, but compassion. Compassion. That got him in trouble. Such chutzpah was just as threatening then as it is now. Usually such folks get disposed of fairly quickly. We began with the physicist Niels Bohr outwitting a professor. In closing, I want to turn to the words of another physicist, J. Robert Oppenheimer. He was a renowned scientist deeply involved in the Manhattan Project during World War II. And the anguishing decisions over nuclear weaponry. After the war, Oppenheimer was among those hounded to death, literally, by the fundamentalist zealots of McCarthyism. And yet he stayed grounded in humility amidst the arrogance of certainty that his opponents rallied against him. These were Dr. Oppenheimer's words, and with this we will close. This cannot be an easy life. We shall have a rugged time of it. To keep our minds open and to keep them deep, to keep our sense of beauty and our ability to create it, and our occasional ability to see it in places remote and strange and unfamiliar. We shall have a rugged time of it, all of us, in keeping these gardens in our villages, in keeping open the intricate casual pathways, to keep these flourishing in a great, open, windy world. But this, as I see it, is the condition of humanity. And in this condition, we can help because we can love one another. End of quote, J. Robert Oppenheimer. May it be so.